folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. All righty. Let's do a Mind of the Resuscitationist show. Now, normally I don't discuss cases, because that's just fraught with peril. But this one I've embargoed for a year, and I've changed all sorts of patient details, so I think it's kind of safe to discuss. This is a case of a 52-year-old female I got on sign-out. I walked into my shift. I was hearing about this patient. It's a patient with septic shock. They didn't know the source. They thought maybe it was SBP because the patient has a history of liver failure. Patient's also a renal failure patient on dialysis. And they signed out the patient as being on 30 micrograms of noradrenaline, and they had put on a second vasopressor. They had the patient on a vasopressin. And I look up at the vital sign monitor, and the patient's MAP is reading like 38, 42. Not good. And so this is the patient I get on sign out. And anytime a patient's on two pressors with a MAP of 40, that's really, really bad, as anyone who's practiced resuscitation knows. And in fact, before I even add on a second pressor agent, I have what I call my second pressor stop point. And I like doing these stop points for a lot of things in emergency department critical care and resuscitation, because they make me and the team actually think about things for a minute, as opposed to just blindly going down a clinical path that might or might not be the right thing to do. So I always, at the point, and it's usually in septic shock, because that's the one where really you're dealing with a lot of vasodilatory problems. So anytime I have a septic shock patient who I'm about to think, maybe I should add on a second pressor because the patient's blood pressure is still low, I do this cognitive stop point thing. Now, you could go to the show notes and see all the things I'm going to discuss right now listed on a slide. But essentially, the second pressor cognitive stop point, the first thing I ask myself is, did I really volume load this patient enough? I might have been using objective measures like IVC, like cardiac output monitor, but I just, even despite it, using those things, or if I empirically loaded the patient, I stop and I ask myself, really, did I give enough volume? Really, did I recheck if something changed in the patient's cardiovascular situation that would allow me to give some more volume? And before I give that second pressor, I wrestle with myself, should I just give them some more fluid? Because oftentimes that is the problem, is you just haven't volume loaded them enough. All right, if I've gone through that and I've decided, no, their volume actually is good, then I'll ask myself, did I check the ionized calcium? Am I missing that? If the iCal is low, they're not getting good inotropy. And if they're not getting good inotropy, they're not going to effectively mount a good blood pressure. They're not going to have a good MAP. And because, you know, cardiac output is essential to that. And so I ask myself, well, is the iCal good? And if it's not, I'm going to replace the calcium before adding on a second pressor. Calcium chloride through a central line or a trusted big AC line, otherwise calcium gluconate. Next question on the stop point is this an inotropy issue? Secondary, you know, separate from calcium, is the calcium okay, but there's still an inotropic issue going on? Is it just that their heart's not beating very well? And I'll actually check this. I'll actually throw on the echo probe and look at the heart and see, you know, just qualitatively, is it beating hyperdynamically or is it just kind of lagging there, not doing much at all? And if it's that latter case, I might try a little dobutamine before I add on a second pressor, especially if like the MAP is, you know, just a little bit under the goal. You know, you get your MAP of 55, 60. It's not where I want, but I have some room that if the dobutamine causes a little bit of vasodilation, it's not going to, you know, crash the patient's blood pressure. So I could give it a shot. I could put them on 2.5 or 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute of the dobutamine and see what happens. Sometimes their heart will start pumping and their blood pressure will go up and you won't need a second pressor agent. Next on the list, and this was suggested to me by my good buddy and fellow ED intensivist, Sean Zhang, he said, well, you should always ask yourself, is the patient occultly bleeding? Are they having a GI bleed, for instance, that you just missed because they weren't vomiting? So I guaiac these patients at this point. I make sure their hemoglobin's okay and it's not dropping over the course of their time with me. And obviously, if they're bleeding, what they need is blood, not a second pressor agent. Then we get into the endocrine stuff, and I ask myself, well, is this adrenal insufficiency? Could it be real adrenal insufficiency, a patient who is on steroids long-term, a patient who has known adrenal axis issues? Well, those patients need steroids. You might argue that even patients who don't have that stuff at baseline might have critical illness-induced corticosteroid insufficiency, and I'm not going to wade into that whole debate, except to say that most folks out there accept that when you're on high-dose vasopressors, you know, 20, 30 of noradrenaline, and you're still hypotensive, those patients are probably deserving of some steroid repletion, and these patients are closer to the Anon patients, and probably you could get away with, without too much debate, giving some hydrocortisone. I give 100 milligram stress dose to these patients and see what happens. Whether it's from their baseline illness or from their current critical illness, I think you get away with it if you're on 30 of noradrenaline. Next one up for endocrine, are you missing hypothyroidism? Does the patient have a history of it, in which case, wow, this is really strong on our differential, or have they just developed and this is their first diagnosis of it? Because catecholamines don't work so great without the presence of thyroid hormone. And then the last thing on my cognitive step point for at the point where I'm ready to add the second pressor is wacky stuff. And that's what we're going to discuss in this case. So we'll leave it for a second and we'll come back to that wacky stuff point. The other thing I always would do when taking sign out on a patient like this, I wouldn't need to if it was my patient because I would have already done it. But on any hypotensive patient where I don't know exactly what's going on, I perform a RUSH exam. And RUSH stands for rapid ultrasound for shock and hypotension. If you haven't heard about this, I have a link in the show notes. I invented this with a couple of my ultrasound buddies, Danny Duque and Brett Nelson. You might see another RUSH out there in the literature that was developed subsequent to ours, and those folks are very nice, and I'm not going to talk about how two exams got named the same thing because it makes me very frustrated, but the point is I'm talking about my RUSH exam, which you could find linked in the show notes, and essentially it's a way of discerning why a non-trauma patient is hypotensive. And the way you approach a RUSH exam is an acronym called HIMAP, H-I-M-A-P. And that is the steps and the order in which you take to analyze why a medically shocked patient is hypotensive or in shock. And so essentially you just go and you look at the heart, that's the H, you look at the IVC for the I, you look at Morrison's and the other abdominal views, that's the M, the A is the aorta, and the P is pneumothorax and pulmonary windows. And if you do all that, you'll get a pretty good idea of what's going on with the patient. And I don't add that to my cognitive step point for a second pressor because I would have already done that. But if you come in as a sign out, you're getting this patient on sign out, then I would do my RUSH right away if it hasn't already been done, because you never want to assume that something crazy is not going on until you rule those things out. And we'll talk more about that as well in just a bit. So to get back to this patient, first, when I see they're hypotensive on two pressors already and high doses of two pressors, the first thing I do is I perform my RUSH exam. So how does the RUSH exam look on this patient? Well, we do the heart and it's contracting like crap. It's just kind of standing there like a bag of worms. You know, it's moving every now and then, but nothing I want to see in a shocked patient. So I'm not happy with that. Then I look at the IVC and it's kind of flattish. It's not a big IVC at all. It's kind of tiny and the patient's on a vent. So you'd actually, if the patient's fluid down, expect it to get bigger with the mechanical ventilations, and it's not really moving much at all. So it's small and not moving. And then I get to my my Morrison's and abdominal fast views, and what I see is a massive, massive fluid, which we assume is ascites, which is a fair assumption given the cirrhotic patient who's had previous episodes of ascites. And I move to my aorta. Aorta looks fine, no problem there. And my lung windows, my pneumothorax and pulmonary windows, there's no pneumothorax to explain why this patient's so profoundly hypotensive. And there's actually no fluid in the lungs. Now, so why do you do this RUSH exam? Well, you don't want to be adding on a second pressor, or you don't want to be treating a patient with vasopressors and fluids when it turns out they have a cardiac tamponade, which you'll pick up on your heart windows, or they have a leaking AAA, which you'll pick up on your aortic windows, or they have a tension pneumothorax, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we've done the RUSH exam, and now I have a pretty good picture of what's this not. It's not one of those secondary obstructive causes. And I have a pretty good picture of the things that are contributing to this patient's hypotension, like a flat IVC and horrible heart contractility and massive ascites. So what do I want to do on this patient? Well, first off, looking at that heart, if I'm going to put a second pressor on this patient, they have the patient on vaso, but with a heart with no contractility, I actually would prefer my second pressor to be epinephrine. So we plan to switch on that. The nurses are mixing that up. So we're going to switch out the vaso. We're going to put on an epi drip because that will give me further constriction. But more importantly, it'll give me a good inotropic beta stimulation. So we're going to be doing that. I check the patient's iCal. It's a little low. So we give some calcium chloride through the central line. And the IVC is flat. Okay, well, let's try some more fluids. The patient already had, I think, 4 or 5 liters. But let's give another liter, see what happens. Because flat IVC, give it a shot. I'm not going to go into that again. Haney will come to my house and kill me. And then, like I mentioned, this patient's on high-dose 2 pressors. I don't think anyone's going to argue steroids are probably worth a shot at this point. So we give the patient hydrocortisone, 100 milligrams. And look up at the arterial line, good waveform, still map of like 40. Not happy with this. Okay, so I mentioned those massive ascites, and the belly's hard as a rock. And so first off, we need some fluid to send for cultures and analysis, see if this is spontaneous bacterial peritonitis as the cause of this patient's sepsis. But I'm also thinking something else, and this something else is a little bit in that wacky stuff category, which is this patient has massive ascites and a belly that's hard as a drum. Is this a condition called abdominal compartment syndrome? Now, we usually see ACS, abdominal compartment syndrome, in the setting of a post-trauma patient or a post-operative patient, especially one who got a ton of fluids, and maybe they went to the OR and then got their belly closed, and all that fluid resuscitation could lead to a situation where the abdominal, intra-abdominal pressure actually rises and starts decreasing perfusion to the organs, leading to signs of shock. It decreases venous return to the heart because the IVC is being compressed down by all that pressure in the abdomen. So they get poor cardiac output, and therefore they get more perfusion deficits, and therefore more swelling and misery in the organs, and therefore more increased intra-abdominal pressure. And then, you know, all the respiratory stuff, because these patients always wind up on mechanical ventilation as they start going into shock state, that's pushing down on the abdomen further, and it's a big mess. And so usually we're not used to seeing this in emergency medicine, but you can see this in massive ascites patients, especially in massive ascites patients who have gotten a bunch of volume repletion. So is that what's going on? So since we're going to tap the patient anyway, we get in there with a catheter, we go subumbilical, and I actually transduce the pressure, and the pressure is around 28 millimeters of mercury, and that's well into the abdominal compartment syndrome area. Where I start worrying is that part of the reason this patient is doing so crappy? Is that part of the reason why the patient's cardiac output is bad is because they're not getting any venous return? And so we actually take out 3 or 4 liters of that ascites fluid to see if we could get that abdominal pressure down. Is that going to make things better? So we do that, and the pressure does come down. And now the belly's not tense at all. It's nice and soft. And we remeasure the pressure. Now it's well under 10. So that seems good. And you know what? We'll give the patient back some albumin because they still need fluids. And that, you know, we don't use a lot of albumin in the U.S., but I think it's a good way to go on a sick patient who you're doing paracentesis on. So we give some 25% albumin. Feeling pretty good about that. So now we've done a lot of stuff, and guess what's happening to patient's blood pressure? Nothing. Nothing. It's still hanging out right there at that same level. In fact, now it's a little bit lower. It's like a map of like 35. Okay, now we get to the second stop point. So the second stop point, this is the mind of a resuscitationist. This is where we come into that part of the discussion. Anytime you have a situation during resuscitation where things just really aren't adding up, where you're not sure what's going on, you do this stop point. And in a case like this where we've done a whole bunch of resuscitative steps and the patient's blood pressure is actually going down, it doesn't make any sense. So I do my cognitive stop point. And the first thing I do to enact this is I say to my team and to myself, I say, I have no idea what the f*** is going on here. Now, why do I do that? Well, first of all, it does a few things to your team dynamics. It tells everyone involved that you're not sure exactly what's going on, and that gives them the freedom to chime in with any thoughts they have. You see, I'm kind of an imposing guy, I've been told. I don't know what people are talking about. And oftentimes, people might have their ideas about a situation, and they might feel scared to say it. And you want to never let that happen. You always want your team to feel absolutely free to give their viewpoints, because oftentimes they're seeing the situation more clearly than you may be, and you want them to feel open to do that. And when you say, I have no idea what's going on here, they might be thinking it, but they're too scared to say it. They might be too scared to seem silly or what have you. Let them say it. And that's you giving them the freedom to do it by just announcing out loud, I really don't know what's going on here. And so I do that all the time in these situations. And then we could brainstorm as a team, and everyone feels very safe that they have no idea what's going on. I have no idea what's going on. And so let's think this through. So that's the first thing I do. The second thing in this cognitive stop point is get rid of all your assumptions you have about the case. You're assuming a lot of stuff, and you get sign out on these, and you assume that might be true, or you might assume things that you've took to be fact just from things people have told you. Get rid of all of it and start fresh. And start going through the things you know and asking yourself, are these assumptions or are these absolute swear on your life facts? And only put into the mix the things that are swear on your life facts. And then once you have the things that you absolutely are sure of, then you start troubleshooting. And the way you troubleshoot, I think, is from an engineering perspective. You see, when I went to med school at Mount Sinai, they had really good programs. Like, I got in through humanities and medicine, meaning like I was like one of those poet doctors. I didn't do any pre-med classes. I didn't do anything. I just did, well, I'm not going to talk about what I did during college, but the point is I wasn't a pre-med guy, and they still took us, and they thought that was valuable to have people that weren't from the standard path. Well, the other thing they did is they had engineers. They actually drafted from engineering school people to come to med school, and they went to their campuses and said, well, we'll take you right now, you know, just a few years into college, and you'll know you're accepted to med school if you finish off your engineering degree and then come to us. And I thought that was brilliant because these engineers have a whole different way of thinking about things. And I was friends with a bunch of these guys, and they gave me their viewpoint to troubleshooting, which is the way an engineer troubleshoots is they accept nothing as fact, and they test every link in the chain until they find the one that's broken. And this is how we should do things in resuscitation as well. You know, when I have a chest tube with a massive air leak, the way you troubleshoot that is you first clamp at the point where the chest tube's entering into the patient's chest. And you clamp there, and if there's still an air leak, you know it's an equipment failure. And you keep moving your clamp backwards on the equipment until you find the point where the air leak disappears. And then you know that between the patient and that clamp, that's where the air leak is. And there's probably a hole in the chest tube somewhere, or a hole in the tubing connecting the pleurovac, or what, you know, something like that. On the other hand, if you clamp at the patient and the air leak stops, well, now you know the problem is intrathoracic, and it's certainly a continuous, you know, bronchopleural fissure. And now you very quickly figured out whether it's an equipment issue or a patient issue. That's the engineering type troubleshooting. Well, now you got to do the same thing for any resuscitation situation. So when I ask myself at this cognitive stop point, why am I doing all this stuff that should at least make the patient's blood pressure a little bit better? Like, I'm not asking for miracles here, but it should be getting better with all the stuff I did. I mean, I put the patient on epi, it should have increased their contractility. We took away all that massive intra-abdominal pressure. That should have made the blood pressure better through venous return. We gave albumin, we gave fluids, we gave calcium, we gave steroids, all this stuff. It might not send them up to 65, but it should have made them a little bit better, and it didn't. So now I say, eliminate all baseline assumptions. Am I missing something? And so, I look back up at that arterial line, and it has a beautiful waveform, and it's reading a map of 35. But I say to myself, well, what's going on here? Is this the problem? And so the first thing I do is I put on a blood pressure cuff, and the blood pressure cuff is reading 140 over 80. 140 over 80, blood pressure cuff. And this might be why you want to keep a blood pressure cuff on if you have any doubt about the quality of your arterial line, and just like run it every 20 minutes just to see. Okay, well now I'm suspicious. So what I do is I take my pressure transducer and I transduce the central line as well. That's up in the neck, and the maps match. So now one of two things is happening. Either the central line has been placed in an artery, and I don't think so, or the arterial line has been placed in a vein. And that's what was happening, is that arterial line was placed in a vein. Now, how could that happen? Well, this patient already had a high CVP from their abdominal compartment syndrome. So when you place that femoral arterial line, you're going to get a higher pressure than you're used to. and it's going to be pulsatile. And this is something most people don't understand, is that CVP is a pulsatile flow. Central venous pressure is pulsatile. But usually the pressures are so low that the difference between the upstroke and the downstroke is so minimal that it looks like continuous flow. But if you ever looked at a CVP waveform, it is pulsatile. And as the CVP pressure keeps going up and up, that degree of pulsatility, it looks more and more arterial. And so this is what had happened. They had placed the femoral line in the vein, but it looked like an arterial pressure because who sees a venous pressure of 50 over 30? So that's what took place. And so I put in a new arterial line, and now I stripped off the epinephrine. I just had the patient on Orepi. I dropped it to 15, and now all of a sudden I have a MAP of 65. And so that's why you got to do a cognitive stop point. That's why you got to do your arterial lines under ultrasound guidance, always, I think, unless it's a crash line. That's why you have to never assume anything. So what's the take-home message of this show? Take-home message of the show is first to talk about the stop point when you're going to add on a second vasopressor, and then perhaps more importantly, the stop point of a resuscitationist, which is when anytime things aren't going the way they should from your clinical previous, you know, history dealing with patients, stop yourself, say, I don't know what's going on, talk to your team, get rid of all your baseline assumptions, and then troubleshoot every possible thing that could be going on until you find the thing that is. All right, we covered a bunch of stuff in there. I hope this was useful. Write in the comments if it was, and if you have any thoughts about the things we discussed. I just want to do some shout-outs. You know I don't do many of these, but I think it's worth it. First of all, Shad Ruby from Ohio Life Flight sent me T-shirts just out of the blue because he's a super nice guy. Thank you, sir. I really appreciate them. That's just so sweet of you. Next, my friend Ken Grauer, a longtime listener of the show, sent me a new copy of his book to review, ACLS 2013, The Pocket Brain Book. And this is just a really excellent book. It discusses all the ACLS algorithms, but then takes them further to discuss the things that the AHA didn't put in there. It's a pocket-sized book. It's quite nice. I have the link to the book in the show notes, and I want to give away this copy. I've read it. I've digested it. I've taken notes on it, and then I give the books away. That's what I do. I'm going to choose from my Twitter followers. So if you're already following me on Twitter, then you're already set. If you're not, then follow me in the next 2 or 3 days, because then I'm going to pick a winner randomly from my Twitter followers. And then next shout out, Clay Smith, my longtime friend from Vanderbilt down south. He's been doing the Keeping Up podcast. He did it for a while, then took a break, and then came back, and they've been better than ever. He has an app on iTunes for the iPhone and the iPad called Upshot. It's free, so that means, you know, no money. So go get it. It's amazing. He's reviewing all these articles. He's putting them there. There's links to the audio. There's links to the reviews. There's links to the article abstract itself. It is a beautiful app. Check it out. Clay Smith, good man. All right, I've gone over my time. I'm sorry. We will stop there. I hope to hear from you in the show notes. If you're not already subscribing to the CME and you aren't attending, well, then you are just wasting your time listening and then not getting CME credit. So stroll on over to cme.mcrit.org to find more information about that. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.